Phone call with Paul, who was coughing his lungs up here a day or two ago, and gathered that this is a relatively new kind of a thing you're doing here in these evenings. You're looking for, as I understand it, about 30 minutes, hoping to have a lot of group discussion. Is that correct? It's supposed to fall on you primarily, I guess. And so I get this call, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, in the first place, I'm not very good at this, I think. I'm more of that, you know, didactic presenter kind of a guy. So this will be kind of fun for me tonight, I think. But, you know, I got to look at it that, and I thought, okay, well, it sounds to me like what I need to do is to find the most controversial subject I can imagine. Something that will just enrage and inflame. and then we'll have this wild discussion and find out if we still love each other when it's over. And so I've done that very thing, as a matter of fact. I kid you not. I looked for something that has proven to be, throughout the years, at least for me, every time I would present my lesson on this material, it would spark all kinds of feedback. So get ready tonight. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Likely we might have a bit of a lively discussion. One very personal side note before we get started, and I'd like to have another prayer. What I'm sure none of you will know is that my wife, Donna, you see, is not here tonight. She lost her mother this week. Velma passed away on Thursday. Velma Fox, her original name, maiden name Wilkins, married Sam Fox, and they had four kids. When Donna, the third of these children, that's all right, she's the second, but when Donna was only 14 years old, her father had a stroke. The doctors mishandled it, by all accounts, and made it very much worse. And as a consequence, Donna was only 14 when effectively she lost her dad. He never spoke again. He never stood again. He never fed himself again. He was entirely incapacitated. For over 20 years, Donna's mom cared for that man in every conceivable way. She was the woman that kept him alive and took care of his every bodily function, his every need. He was completely incapacitated. He was not a Christian when this took place. Donna's parents had been, Donna's mother's parents had been, but, you know, she married a man who was an unbeliever. And so Velma's married to Donna's dad. He's not a Christian, and it would take, I think, 15 years of her getting him up every Sunday morning, putting him in the wheelchair and taking him to those assemblies, that he, unable to speak, did some kind of sign language that they'd worked out. But this particular request that he was asking for wasn't on their regular list, and it took quite a long time before they figured out what he was asking was to be baptized into Christ. And so that example from Donna, age 14, seeing her mom care for this, terribly debilitated man, and then him coming to Christ as a result, I think had, you know, enormous influence over who Donna became. And she is just a fabulous woman. She and I have never had a fight in 44 years of marriage. We've only a handful of times had even what you might think of as a degree of tension that, you know, has arisen. It's been absolutely blissful. And I owe all that to her mother. So Donna's in Kansas right now with the family. They're taking care then of a memorial. But if you could find a moment or two, prayer of comfort for her in this loss, it is a big one for us. Paul, do you lead in prayer? Are you comfortable leading in prayer? Would you lead us in prayer, please, just with that one thought for Donna's comfort?
Father, living this life,
to the book of Romans. It'd be very important that you look at the text, I think, here this evening. So everybody dig out those phones if you're into the newer technology, or find a paper if that's what you're still clinging to as I am. I want to open up to Romans and the 13th chapter. And tonight we'll be looking at just the first few verses here in Romans chapter 13. Christianity is an eminently practical religion. It is a religion that is not about all kinds of mysteries and mysticism, as so many are, all of these unknown things that intrigue people. But it is a religion of revelation, so that we are to understand clearly what God has said about His plans for us. But it's also most particularly a working faith, or really no faith at all, a dead faith. It's a faith that is to be lived out, observed by others, and become a motivator for other people to want to join us in the kind of life that we are living. So tonight I gathered that you are looking for something very practical. Let's look at Romans chapter 13. In chapter 13 and verse 1, you have this statement: let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority, I'm reading the New American Standard, there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. Wherefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And we'll stop right there. Everybody knows, Romans 13 is about the governing authorities. Now let's see if we can get just the tiniest little bit of feedback. So Paul's writing to the saints in what city? Rome. Rome is what city? It is the capital of the Roman Empire. At this point in time, is there any superpower that could rival Rome? No. And for the last 3 years at least, before this book was written, who's the emperor of Rome? 54 AD to 68. It's Nero. Now, Nero is just a real nice guy. Everybody loved him. Would have had 100% vote for Nero, right? No, not even. Now, truth be told, and the man is maligned more than he ought to be, though he deserves his fair share. Apparently, he was an extremely capable administrator. He was a good emperor in the beginning from purely a government standpoint. And it was only later that he seemed to be losing his mind for reasons that people are not sure of. So from the start, he wasn't terrible, and he really was a pretty good emperor for administrative purposes. But we all know where this is going to go. And when Paul writes this letter, no matter where you go, these people are in Rome, but in the biggest thing there is on the planet at the time, Nero's the emperor. And what does that first verse tell you to do? If you're a Christian in the first century, under Rome, with Nero as the emperor, what does that first verse say? Be in subjection. What is subjection? It is being obedient. Think for a second and try to develop this a little bit. What does subjection necessarily imply and suggest? If I'm going to be in subjection to something, then what?
You obey whether you like it or not.
Whether you like it or not. Somebody says to me, hey, would you like to have a bowl of ice cream? Am I going to go, well, okay, you know, if that's what you want, then I will be in subjection to your will. But what happens when somebody offers me ice cream? Dennis knows, he thinks a lot about his meals. Okay, I like ice cream. So when I get to do what I already want to do, have you seen in me any subjection? No. What is a similar word to subjection that carries, you know, almost identical ideas? Subjection and submission. Took it right out of your mouth, didn't they? Subjection and submission. In both cases, what prefix does that start with?
Sub.
And what have I done to myself? Sub. What have I done? Yes, what is a submarine? When you have sub involved, it's a matter of order and ranking, and the sub thing is what? Underneath the other. If I am to be in subjection to the governing authorities, then what is required of me? Whether I like it or not.
Humble yourself.
I've got to humble myself. I've got to submit. I've got to say, I may not like it. Doesn't seem right. I disagree entirely. I think this is foolish, stupid, counterproductive, even dangerous. But if I'm in subjection, then what? Then I'm going to do that thing, aren't I? Be in subjection to the governing authorities. Now, does this verse still apply wherever you are on the planet? Sure it does. Now, there's an awful lot of governing authorities. But when I'm under a governing authority, whatever that governing authority is, what is the Christian's role?
Submission.
So I may be in a country that says one thing about a certain thing. Next week, I'm in a country that says the exact opposite about that same thing. When I'm in this country, what's my behavior like? Whatever that law says. Walk across the border, and it's the exact opposite, and what now? I'm a Christian, so what? I'm going to be in submission. Now, I don't want to explore this tonight. I know everybody's familiar with it. We understand that any time it's contrary to some statement of God, God is the higher ranking authority. There are times when I may have to violate a law that requires me to be in contradiction to the highest of all laws. I must be in subjection to my God first. But, brethren, it's really not very often, is it? Can you think of too many times when the government asks you to do something and you just have to stand up with all of that courage and defy whatever the forces are, you know, and prison and death itself to go do what the government's asking you to do? How often does that happen?
Not till just lately.
Okay. Now, no doubt this would be a very controversial subject for another class. Okay, I'm not sure. But yeah, I understand the circumstances, and I want you to play with them a little bit tonight, too. I mean that. But I am going for one specific thing here in just a minute. So, where did the authority come from? You're looking at your Bible in verse 1. Where did it come from? Did it come from Nero?
No.
Not really. The authority came from God for Nero to have this power. Now, will Nero be judged by God for how he wields that power? Yes. But am I free to just pick and choose what laws I want to obey? Are you sure?
Unless it violates God's law.
Unless it violates God's law. But if it doesn't, what is my responsibility?
Obedience.
It's obedience. It's humble submission. Now, while it's not developed right here, I think it appears in other places, and no doubt you've been taught along these lines before. What happens when you are in submission to even insignificant things, but you choose to subjugate your own will and decision and you do what the other person thinks? Is that good for you?
Yes.
Is it healthy? Is it helpful?
As a child, it's painful.
As a child, it's very, very painful. But what happens when parents require that the children obey? What are they training those children? Let me give you an example. When I was about, I would guess I was about 10 years old. I have two brothers. So they were 9 and 8, 8, 9, and 10. We're out Lake Havasu, hiking around in the canyons around Lake Havasu, out there in the desert, with our dad. And all of a sudden, two things happen. We hear a loud rattling. And my dad says, "Freeze!" Now, when my dad said, "Freeze!" at the sound that none of these little boys had ever heard before. In my family, what happened when my dad said freeze? We went to statues. I mean it. My dad had a belt that he took off with a flourish and used with great joy, it seemed, though I knew it really wasn't. But when my dad said something, in my family, when I was a kid, there was no question. There was no hesitation. He had a piercing whistle you could hear a block away. My dad had instructed the three sons, "You hear my whistle, you do not walk, you run." And literally, we would be playing next door or two doors down. My dad whistled, and we would drop what we were doing, and you'd see three little boys hurtling down the street fast as we could go. Because there was a belt waiting at the other end. And if we didn't do what Dad told us to do, three little bodies froze. About 12 to 18 inches away on a ledge that was on a direct line with my brother's neck sat that rattlesnake. Dad didn't know where it was. We didn't know where it was. But nobody moved save my dad's head. Till he figured out where it was. That snake died. We kept the rattle for a long time. Okay? But why did that happen? And would that have happened in most families? Most families, dad, mom say to do something, and what happens? Nothing. The kids totally ignore it. They just continue doing what they're doing. I have absolutely no doubt that day dad saved my brother's life. We were not just up the canyon, we were fully 30 minutes from the opposite shore in the desert of Lake Havasu, where a medical facility of any kind would have been fully another hour's drive. There was no hope for survival for that little kid. What I'm saying is, if you train yourself to be in submission, then it becomes a habit. It becomes an automatic response. It doesn't require thought. You just simply respond instantly. And that kind of training is extremely valuable for Christians. Satan will unleash his temptations at all times. We are supposed to be ready for those missiles. You don't want to have to sit down and go through a whole computation on what you're to do. You train yourself for it. Now, no authority except from God. Those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed what? The ordinance of Nero? Rome? The Constitution? What are you in opposition to? God, verse 2, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. Condemnation if you choose not to obey. Now then, here's where the discussion part starts. Do not think, give me the habit. When you're driving down the street, you see a sign, it's black and white, and the black says 4-5. What does everybody know you can do? 16. Everybody knows that. Now, this is where the controversy started every single time I've ever taught this class. So I ask people, is it legal for you to drive 50 in a 45? And almost universally among Christians, I mean nearly ever without an exception, is it legal for you to drive 50 in a 45? Raise your hand if you think yes. Okay?
May I explain?
May I explain? Let the discussion begin.
I was once a cop.
Okay.
And when we saw people driving 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, they told me one thing. One, they know how what the law says. They know it's supposed to be 45. They're not going 60 or 70. They're going 5 miles over. And something else, when they see your car, they automatically go down 5 miles an hour. They're paying attention to what's going on around you. So therefore, what's a cop's job? Keep you safe.
Oh.
This driver is paying attention to what's going on, and he is driving safely. And I can assume that people around him are going to be safe, too, because of his conduct.
Okay. I think every congregation I've ever preached for has had policemen in it. In fact, one of them had worked his way all the way up to SWAT teams and did a presidential protection detail one time. He's in the process of writing a book, which I can't wait, you know, to read. He's really had some true adventures. Okay, everyone, you know, I've talked to policemen about this. Now, let's hone in on this for just a minute. What does everybody, and I mean almost without exception in the church, also think? Is it legal to drive 50 when it says 45? It is not legal. Is it permissible?
It's tolerated.
Now here's a guy nearly dead who can't preach, who's raising his hand. Am I a great discussion leader or what?
That question is so good. Over the years, I've taken repeated opportunity to ask law enforcement officers, state patrol, out of state, local, this and that. Because they say, well, really, you're not allowed to hide. Blah, blah, you're permissible, this and that. They say, if the law says, I'll just choose that speed, 45, that's the speed limit. It's not 46. I said, but why don't you stop people? He said, if I stop people going over the speed limit, I have to stop everybody. But the speed limit is the limit.
Okay.
I ask officers, what about infractions of the headlight is out? One patrolman said, well, on that, you're supposed to have two operative headlights. But if the right headlight is out, I'll probably let them go by. I don't want the left headlight out in case oncoming traffic thinks he's just a motorcycle. I talk to another cop. He said, absolutely not. He said, because if he's got the right one out and the left one goes out. He said, we're there to try to protect people. But in this case, 45 is the law.
Okay.
Regardless of what we do about it, what cops permit about it, that's the law.
Now, that's the thing I wanted to key in on, and this is something that most people really miss. Does a policeman have legal authority to choose whether or not he's going to enforce the law as it stands? Do they have legal authority to make judgment calls on particular infractions? Yes, they do. Here's the hook. Do you have legal authority to make judgment calls on the law? You just read it, and the answer is, in black and white, N-O, white background, okay, on the side. It's absolutely no, but everybody thinks so. Now, I do want to add one more thing. Why do they have this judgment? A, they understand that tires wear out, and that affects what your speed says on the speedometer. So they know that what it clocks, you know, may be what your speedometer says. They are free to allow some leeway. You are not. You don't get to make those choices. Now, I want to add one more thing. I was very surprised. I didn't think it would happen in this state because I've done this in several states now. It sounded to me like when I said 45, how fast could you go, that more than one of you said 60. Now, I want to know, in all seriousness, you have to tell me, were you just joking or were you serious? Okay, well, yeah, but I'm not asking, you know, again, what I'm asking is, what do people in Washington State think they have the right to do if they see a 45-mile speed limit?
Go 10 over, do an
I-5. Now, Okay, I heard 10 now. I've heard 15. Does anybody have another answer?
You could go Mach 2 if there's not a copper.
Okay, all right. I know people talk about cotton. By the way, I won't have time to get into this, but I once had a man say to me, he said, look, here's how the law works. If you accept the penalty, you can do whatever you want. So if I want to break the speed limit by 50 miles an hour because I'm a wealthy guy and I can pay the ticket, that's okay. Is it? You may be able to afford to pay the penalty, but what did the passage say you were to do? Be in subjection. Not break the law and pay it off. Said to be in subjection, didn't it? Now at this point I'll reveal something that I think places me far above the policeman. I taught driver's ed. I taught driver's ed for three different schools, both public and private. I only got in trouble a couple of times and I did in fact survive. What I'm saying is this. When you meet virtually any driver for the rest of your life, will they have ever read the driving laws? Will they have ever really immersed themselves in the questions about what the law says? Will any of them have been driver's ed teachers? No. What do most people actually know about the laws? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. It's astonishing. How many people, after the age of 16, your birthday, and 2 days later you get your license, will ever think about a driving law again? Take a refresher course. Buy a book on the subject. How traffic works. I can recommend some of these books, and I think they're fascinating. There's a book that's entitled Traffic. And it's great. It tells you why traffic works the way it does. It tells you so you can understand what's the right thing to do in bumper-to-bumper traffic. And nobody has ever read the book, thinks about it. Everybody does it wrong, and that's the sole reason we have traffic jams. They're utterly unnecessary. But it's because everybody thinks that they know the law, having never read it. Everybody thinks that the urban myths are true, that everybody's doing what they want, but not what the law would suggest. They're not engineers, they're not designers of roads, but this book was written by people who designed the roads and can tell you how they're supposed to fit. Now, when we're looking at this passage about obeying these speed limits, I travel the country and doing meetings and stuff, have just truly been shocked. Up until this class, in Washington State, the answer always was 5 miles. You can always drive 5 miles over the limit, and a policeman will never give you a ticket if you're 5 miles over the limit. If the police choose not to give you a ticket at 5 miles over the limit, did that give you a legal right to drive 5 miles over the limit? No, it didn't. It gave him a legal right to pass a judgment. But what I've learned is it's utterly fascinating. It totally depends on the local area what their myth is. So if you go to Montana, what do they think you get to add to the black and white statement on the sign?
As far as you want to go.
Okay. I've heard that in that state, the general answer is 15 to 20. So now you're looking at 70. What do they think they can do? 85 to 90. And that's their myth. That's their legend. Okay, let me elaborate upon that. Okay, what the law says is whatever's written on that sign is permissible during daylight hours on a sunny day with no rain. And if the ideal circumstances, conditions do not exist, then You have to drive safely for the conditions, which is what you just said, and that is the fundamental rule that underlies all driving laws. You are never, now there's life and death emergencies, and I have broken the law, taken a baby to the hospital. That baby lived, but it was close. There's life and death. I'm setting that aside. Those are exceptions. Do exceptions change the rule? No. Could a policeman still give me a ticket for the speeding? Sure. But I'm not talking about that. What the law is that you are to stay at that limit always under all circumstances, and it only applies to ideal conditions. It might be the hard way. Okay. So, brethren, it looks to me like I'm supposed to close at 6 and I got 5:58. I think you all get it now, and I could develop this, you know, ad nauseum, because I really have thought about it a lot. Christians are supposed to set the example. Now, what I want to close with is two things. Will it be hard for you to do this? Oh, yeah. Will people tailgate you and get mad and race around you? Will you be sorely tempted to believe another urban myth? Well, if people are really pressing me like this, then it's dangerous, and then I should match their speed so they're not mad anymore. What would this actually produce? Complete chaos. Everybody's speeding up trying to stay ahead of everybody. That is such a foolish myth. I don't know why people believe that. What does the law say that if you're keeping the law and people start stacking up or driving dangerously, what does the law say you should do? Speed up or what? Pull over and let them go by. But what will that require? Correct. But what I mean is submission, self-control, discipline. It will require active participation in Christianity. It will require that you control the urges that are at war with this entire idea and all the myths that have spread across America. Paul, let me add just one more thing. I just want to get on this one thing and I'll come to you. Guess what? I preached a meeting in a state on the East Coast where the speed limit was 65 and had a long argument with an elder in that congregation that because everybody drove so fast on the freeways in his region, he told me he believed the police required you to drive 90 so that you would not create dangerous circumstances. He argued with me, I mean, to the mattress, that 25 miles an hour was what was necessary to add to a 65 mile an hour speed limit in his area. Is that true? It is utterly and completely false. Now, I'm almost out of time. Paul gets 30 seconds, and I'm close.
If you're creating a dangerous situation.
Because the law requires that you pull over to eliminate the dangerous circumstance. That's what the law says.
How that relates and works actually on the freeway and all those things, there's a degree sometimes of judgment in I'll say advanced driver's training class. I had two of the officers teaching it disagree. Sometimes there's some ambiguity.
But again, that's their realm, not ours.
Well, no, from my standpoint, I said, is it lawful to A, because the law said, well, actually, the previous driving class said, and so sometimes there is some ambiguity within a law, but that aspect, are we doing like the woman did to Jesus? Have you done what you could?
Yeah, and the fundamental law is safety's sake. Okay, now I'll close with this. I've taken 6 o'clock as your closing time. Here, brethren, in light of those first two verses of Romans 13, here's a passage that I haven't heard preached on a lot, but I think for us as Christians ought to be one of the most profoundly important verses that you'll ever hear. It's Luke chapter 16. Open your Bibles up to Luke. In Luke, in the 16th chapter, mark this verse, you know, write it down. Study this with your children. In Luke 16 and verse 10, it says this, Jesus speaking, "He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. If therefore you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous mammon, who will entrust the true riches to you? Judgment, eternal life is being contemplated in Luke 16:10. Your eternal reward. And what he says is, you Christians, and it's also emphatic. It's not just a little thing. It's a very little thing. So let's all grant, all stipulate, the rules of the road are very little things. Now, what's your responsibility? Be faithful in the very little thing. And earlier, I brought this out, and I'll close with it now. If you are faithful in the very little things, you discipline yourself all your life to do that, okay, then it will become what? A habit. You will automatically, unthinkingly, always do meticulously what God asks you to do, from little to the biggest imaginable. And what I've come to believe after years of teaching driver's ed and just thinking all of this through is that just about the best workshop I know is every time you get behind the wheel. Can you control yourself? Do you have discipline? Will you just yield to what the crowd is doing? Does the urban myth matter more to you than what the law says? Do you care or know what the law says? All of these things, brethren, get washed out. You don't have to know what the law says. It's printed on the post. All the philosophy about it, if you want to go and design highways or get into government, is up to you. But what's your job as a Christian? Show the world what discipline is in a very little thing. Show the world what self-control is. Show the world what submission and subjection is. That's what God asked us to do. Be the light of the world. Is this what you're looking for, Rocky? Is that what you want? Okay. Then I can escape with my life? Okay. Paul, are you on the verge of speech or are you just resting your elbow there? All right. Well, let's all hang around and listen to Paul when it's over. But I think it's over. 6 o'clock. So do you end in prayer or anything, or should we just...